Caramcast.
Welcome to the Caramcast episode 13. I'm here with my special co-host Amy Lynn Chadwick in Los Angeles. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
It's been a little while since we've been out, but depending on when you listen to this, that may not make any difference.
Yeah.
Today we want to talk about the world of video making, home video making, and what that means in 2009 as opposed to what it meant in 1988, when you used to have to carry around a gigantic cinder block size camera
and throw in your VHS tapes.
You had to watch grainy homemade videos that you could then send in to America's Funniest Home Videos and have Bob Saget comment on in the most asinine ways.
Right.
Little did we know then that Bob Saget was a sociopathic, dark-humored
freak.
But now it's 2009 and viral video is an tired term for videos that people post that spread at an exponentially fast rate, garnering sometimes into the millions, tens of millions of views for things as innocuous as a kid tripping in the backyard or
a child biting another child's finger.
Which calls to mind the film Idiocracy by Mike Judge, where a man is cryogenically frozen and wakes up 100 years later, only to find out that everybody's IQ has dropped so intensely and spend the majority of their time watching a show called Ow My Balls, which consists of people being kicked, punched, clobbered in the nuts.
Catapulted.
In any number of ways, and that this is what consumes the public interest. Frighteningly, we're seeing a trend like this in what people want to watch these days at places like Daily Motion and E-Bombs World. If you go to a seminar about creating a viral video, they'll usually tell you that to get that wow factor, to get those millions of views, you should generally cover topics like accidents, mishaps, slapstick, goofball humor.
Or boobs.
Or boobs. Well, that's a whole other category.
Right.
And yes, but the placing of a frame of cleavage at the beginning, middle, and final frames of a YouTube video is a popular method actually for making sure that one of your YouTube thumbnails will be of a pair of breasts, regardless of the content in between those. So what we're going to talk about today is ways in which you can shoot high-quality, great-looking videos that can be distributed online and at festivals and elsewhere. They can be migrated back and forth between those different platforms for distribution. What does a successful video make? Why that isn't always necessarily the best thing? And some resources for getting your videos out there that can make life a lot simpler. We're also going to talk about how to optimize your videos so that they look the best when they do go online. When we went to the NAB show a couple of years ago, there was a lot of push by companies, upstarts, that were interested in giving people the ability to broadcast themselves from home. I'm not talking about uploading a 3-minute video to YouTube. I'm talking about a 24-hour stream of videos that come from your channel. You can insert commercials, overlays, top and lower third, text crawls. You can jump to live broadcast at any point from a webcam or other source. One of the companies that was working on this solution is called Mogulus, M-O-G-U-L-U-S. And they, at the time, were in a beta and they were about to launch. And I had checked it out because I was working with somebody who was actually going to launch an old school cable TV station. And I was consulting with to let them know that perhaps the amount of money that would be required to start something like that for the amount of return may not be the wisest at a time like this, where we were seeing a sea change in how broadcasters were going to have to contend with how people are watching their programming. But Mogulus was still a bit fresh and a little wonky. It's definitely been evolving since then. And essentially what it does is it allows you to pull in your content from a variety of streams. You could, for example, have a YouTube channel and plug that into Mogulus, and then all of a sudden all of your videos become available and you can actually queue them up in a playlist and have that streaming day in and day out. And you can say that at a fixed set of intervals, you want to insert an ad or a bumper or a logo or whatever it is. You can also program those top and lower third text crawls to be running throughout the day. So for example, if you think of an infomercial where there's some show going on selling you steak knives, at the bottom, you could see something running across the screen that says 1-800, order now for more information, and so on. Fox News is the people that made this technique the most famous, but now you can do it too at home. There's another thing to know about what you can do with videos, which is that there are, and this is one of the big questions that was always put to YouTube, was how do you monetize the videos that you're working so hard to put together? How do you make money back from them? YouTube's solution is to grant certain content creators the ability to participate in their AdSense affiliate program, which means that they will brand your video with a lower third ad overlay that will feature Google ads that are based on the content within your video, based on keywords and description and so on. I can tell you that the amount of money you'll see from something like that is negligible at best. Even if you have 100,000 views on your video, it would require that somebody click through one of those distracting ads at the bottom of the video, follow that through to a purchase, for which you would make several cents at best. You make a very small commission. So what people do that are savvy to working with affiliate marketing is they choose topics that are going to be associated with high price ticket items. People will make videos about HDTVs and expensive tech and all of that, because if somebody buys a camera, it's obviously going to pay out a lot better than if somebody's buying an MP3 or a record or a dress. That's YouTube's solution to monetization, and it's something that has come from or been paralleled by other companies like Revver.com, that's R-E-V-V-E-R, where you upload your videos and they will match your video with appropriate ads. And anytime somebody watches your video from top to bottom, you are accredited a view. And for every number of views you have, you are building up pennies at a time. It's difficult to get people to watch videos on Revver because they usually have the equivalent on YouTube. People will usually do both. And people obviously will prefer the YouTube version because it's easier to find and they don't have to put up with the ad. But they are both something you can embed in any website, send out in an email or whatever.
When you embed a Revver video onto a website and you're watching it from the website, does it act as?
It still registers that. There's your affiliate ID that's associated in the code itself. So that's how it works. There's these little cookies and these packets and pieces of code that can be followed that will link back to your account and eventually someday in the future pay out. So there's an incentive to create videos that 100,000, a million people, 5 million people will watch. Of course, 10 years ago, that seemed completely impossible. Now that's a daily happening. If you go to a site like viralvideochart.com, they'll show you which videos from any source, from Metacafe, from Dailymotion, from MySpace, or whatever, are the most viral videos of the moment. And they actually have dynamic graph charts that show you how the traffic is peaking or descending. And you can see in different categories, whether it's funny, pets, adult, political, or whatever, what the hot topics are of the day. And you could try to follow them, but as Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis would say, never try to follow the trendsetters. You have to try to be a trendsetter. But you can get a sense, at least, of the kinds of videos about a certain subject that tend to succeed. You can do a video about Obama 1,000 different ways, an infinite number of ways. There's a way that the ones that succeed are framed and edited and contextualized that is different from the ones that people don't bother to watch a second time. So there's this process that goes on of thinking like a producer, thinking of like an executive, like a suit at a studio, where you're thinking of the end result first. You're thinking of who is the demographic, what kind of people do we want to reach, what kind of numbers do we want to do, and then you work your way back to the creative idea, the creative spark. Most artists think in reverse. They think, oh, gee, I feel really interesting today. I feel anxious. There's a full moon. There was that homeless person who threw a coffee at me this morning. Now I want to write a song about it. And then later on, they start thinking, well, maybe I should market it, and I want to look like Britney Spears, or I want to look like the guys from Coldplay or whatever. And they start to frame themselves that way and start slowly telling people this or that about themselves. And there's this like trickle out effect. But by the time your video's out there, it's probably way after the fact. That's if you're playing with the zeitgeist. Obviously, if you're making timeless, beautiful material that will never fall out of fashion, then you have nothing to worry about. And there is an argument for that. I'm a strong proponent of making that kind of content. I believe the flames that will burn forever are eventually going to pay out better than the ones that are a hot topic today and then old news tomorrow. But it's really a matter of how you want to approach it. You certainly should never try to make a viral video to pay your rent, because it won't happen. Even the most successful bloggers, the most successful online producers of content know that this is a slow uphill burn at the beginning. It can take 1-2 years before you really start to saturate the search engines and to get a handle on how this thing works. Unless you are one of those strange anomalies, a 5-second or minute long home video clip that for whatever inexplicable reason, the masses just stick to like flies.
Yeah.
Another service that has come out for monetization is called Overlay.tv. This is a slightly different version of Rever. They don't pay for views, and they're not a YouTube AdSense thing. They actually will watch your content. You give them your video, and they will match it with or suggest choices from their list of 500 different affiliate programs. What an affiliate is a company that wants to get other people to sell their product for them. And in exchange for this, they give you a percentage of a sale. Now, that percentage can be very small. You should always look at what a company's respective commissions are. They can be as low as literally 0% to as high as 75%. And they can include companies like iTunes and Apple, Nike, Rachel Ray. I mean, all sorts of things that are available. So you can actually customize what kind of ads you will have on your site. The approval process is very small. It's usually either an auto-approval thing, or somebody will link back to you within a day or two and say, go ahead, and here's our banner images text, and here's our flash banner text and whatever, and you just place it on your site. And you make sure that your affiliate code, which they give to you, is embedded.
Now, when you put your video on a site like Overlay.tv, how much of your content do they own?
They never own it. They never keep the copyright. Any real legitimate site will have in their agreement that they have, and this is the terminology that they'll typically use, we have a non-exclusive worldwide right in perpetuity or for the universe to distribute, promote, exploit, amend, market, whatever your content. The important part is that it says non-exclusive. As long as it says non-exclusive, they're basically just clearing themselves to be able to display that content with your permission for whatever purpose is necessary. That means you will always retain that copyright. Mm-hmm. You don't ever give that away. If for some reason you ever see a user agreement that says, or acceptance of terms that says, an exclusive right, then stay the hell away from it. This is part of what Facebook got into trouble with recently when they tried to change their terms of use, because essentially they made the smallest change in that contract, which said that they retain the right to that content on their site even after the users have terminated their account. And the reason for this was because if a user was to, say, suspend or close their Facebook account, but they still had emails and so on that they'd written to other people, Facebook wanted to reserve the right to still be able to display that email or those links to the people that are still on Facebook. The loophole here, though, was that it essentially said that anybody who is using Facebook and putting up anything at all is essentially giving Facebook the right to do whatever they want with it and retains the right to do so after the fact. So it was bad verbiage. And Facebook eventually had to turn around and say, we want your input on how to deal with this because, frankly, we can't even figure out how to word this. And they knew that that upset so many people that they were jumping off it like a sinking ship.
They were taking down all their pictures and...
Yeah, it was getting hectic. And it's not that Facebook was trying to be malicious, but it could certainly have been used that way in the language that they had changed it to. there's a couple of really powerful sites that can help you to get your videos out there. One of the ones that I learned about is called TubeMogul, and I'm giving you a little insider secret here. TubeMogul.com actually allows you to upload a single video and then immediately post that to up to 35 different video streaming sites, which include everything from E-Bombs World, Dailymotion, Metacafe, Rever, MySpace, Vimeo, YouTube, dozens AOL. Of others, AOL, Yahoo. Used to be Google Video, but Google Video no longer exists, actually, because it's got subsumed by YouTube. Yahoo, Blip, there's dozens of these. And the cool part about doing this, and the reason that I actually use it, is because it allows you to then track in a graph chart how many views your video has had at all of those sites respectively, and it'll show you in terms of percentage whether your views have gone up or down on any given day. This, to me, is the only way to put up a video. The only caveat, though, is that you can actually put up a gigabyte file on YouTube, but you can only put up a 100 megabyte file at places like Rever and Metacafe and so on. So I prefer the higher resolution version being archived for me online, obviously. So I end up actually putting my YouTube video up separately as a higher resolution file, and then using TubeMogul for all the other video sites so I can track them. But the cool thing is, because my YouTube account is already linked into my TubeMogul account, it'll still report the video back to me and its usage. So it doesn't exclude it from being tracked. It's just, I recommend whenever there is a site that offers you the higher bandwidth version as an upload option to take it. Watching something in HD on YouTube is infinitely better. It sounds much better. It looks much crisper than it does at the lower version. Vimeo is another site that did this, and they actually were one of the earlier ones. They actually preceded YouTube in doing this, where they actually gave you the HD toggle on and off switch, so you could decide whether you wanted to watch something in HD or not, in the event, I guess, that you're using a 2800 baud modem or something for some reason. Or I guess if you're in a Wi-Fi spot, or even watching it on your cell phone is the real reason. And Vimeo is also one of the first ones to actually show videos in widescreen format, as opposed to the standard old square format, which was 640 by 480 or 720 by 480. NTSC, that was the shape of the old square TVs. Some of you may still remember those. Which takes me to formatting your video. When you are making a video, try as often as you can to actually produce and edit and output it in either the letterboxed format or in true widescreen. What letterbox format does is it chops off the top and bottom material so that it would fit in the wider aspect ratio of a film screen and is actually more pleasing to the eye. We have peripheral vision, so when we watch something that's in widescreen, it sort of absorbs your interest more. It's more of an immersion in the material. So if you can't, for whatever reason, up-res your stuff to that format, you can definitely use an aspect ratio that is widescreen. And if you use Final Cut or Vegas or whatever, you'll see that nowadays there is a template preset that will say NTSC standard or NTSC widescreen or HDV widescreen or whatever. Always pick that widescreen format. The worst case scenario, if for whatever reason that video has to play back in a square frame, is it'll simply letterbox it, which looks cooler anyways. Sometimes people used to just letterbox stuff just to make it look more filmic, but there's actually a reason for it. If you play that material back in a widescreen frame, it will actually fill up the screen properly and not show the black bars at the top and bottom. We live in a world where you can now buy a small handheld HD video camera for $230, and that price will drop, I'm sure, again at Christmas. If you go to theflip.com, you'll see the Flip Minnow, I'm assuming,
little
camera. And this shoots at 1260 by 720, which is the HDV standard aspect ratio for your home HDTV screen. Of course, you can go higher resolution. You can go 1440 by 1080, and you can go up to 1920 by 1080, which is full HD. which means you could play something that's shot there on a screen that's three stories high. Granted, there have been festival-winning independent films that were shot on cameras with far lower resolution, so that's really not even a concern. If you want to hear my thoughts about how high resolution you should really shoot, you can visit my site, thehv20experiments.com, and that's where I took my Canon HV20 camera, which now go for under $600, and explored how far you could push it and if you could shoot full film quality material that could be broadcast or streamed or projected in a cinema without compromising the integrity of what you're shooting. And sure enough, you can. There is a certain process to this, and you have to also understand the basic conventions, like how to light something well and how color theory works and how frame rates and shutter speeds work and lenses and optics and all of that. But you can, with that camera, shoot something that it looks as good as Schindler's List. Now, with this flip camera, which is the size of a cell phone, essentially, you can be shooting actual HD material. It's not going to look as good as a camera that has a better lens or better optics, but it's going to look a hell of a lot better than your standard definition camera. The reason for this is it will shoot at 24 frames per second. It'll increase the amount of pixels that are going down and the color depth as well. And so it's going to look more like film because essentially it's shooting either 60i or 30p, or which is 30 frames progressive. Just so you understand, 60i is when something is interlaced. Interlaced means you have a left field of rows, the odd lines that are being drawn across your screen, like 1, 3, 5, 7. And then you've got the right field, which is the even lines, 2, 4, 6. And what happens is that every second frame, they switch out. So you'll have field one, and then field two, and field one, and that's called interlaced. They appear to the eye to be blended together. Progressive is the new HD world, where LCD screens and so on can display all the pixels on the screen at once, at the same time. So progressive means you're seeing a full frame, and a full frame, and a full frame, rather than left field, right field, intermittently. So when you're looking at a camera that says it shoots HD in 60i, it's actually interlaced. And in order for that to look good on a film projector, you would actually have to deinterlace it, which is an intermediary step, and probably decompress it and do all of this other stuff. So you're starting already at a slightly lower source than you would if you're shooting in something that says 30p or 60p or 24p. Those numbers are the number of frames that you're shooting per second. 24p means you're shooting 24 frames progressive per second. And that's exactly what film does. That's what celluloid does. It shoots 24 frames per second, and it exposes the film to whatever the shutter is allowing through frame by frame by frame. That feels great to the eye. That's how we like to see things. That's what film looks like. A webcam typically shoots interlaced video in NTSC at a resolution of like 640 by 480. That's about how high aspect ratio and resolution you're shooting. And that's why it looks like video, like you're watching Three's Company or Family Ties. If you want it to look like you're watching House or Lost, you want to shoot at 24 frames per second, not 30 frames.
No.
Or 29.97 frames.
When you're talking about putting it online into a viral video type of thing, how can you bounce it down from such a big...
Right, that's an amazing question. I'm glad you brought it up, because that's really the essence of what I should be talking about here, not all this other technical stuff. All I'm basically trying to get across is you can shoot at those high resolutions and it'll look really sexy, and that's the reason why it looks sexy. But now you have to get it online. And if you just squish it down in whatever compression program you have, save as, you know, web video or whatever, it'll end up looking like crap again.
Yeah.
So this is an entire art unto itself, is video compression techniques. I won't get too technical, but let me say that there are even programs that are dedicated to doing nothing but this. One of the best is called Sorensen Squeeze. Sorensen actually has their own compression codec for doing this really well, but they also allow you to use all the other codecs like QuickTime and QuickTime's many variations like H.264 and Flash Video and Windows Media Video. Each one of these has its own method for how to figure out what to do with the pixels and the colors and the frame rates so that it's optimized for playback on the web. To understand what that means, just think of what an MP3 is. If I'm recording an orchestra with $15,000 microphones and they've got all this air and all of this dynamic range and all of this stuff happening across the frequency spectrum, it's going to sound like bigger than life. It's going to just overwhelm your senses, and you're going to hear the tiniest air on that, the rosin of the violin string playing, and you're going to hear the thunderous boom of the upright basses and the timpani and all of that happening. And then all of a sudden, you decide that you want to put this up as an MP3. Well, an MP3 has to intelligently figure out what is the most important stuff in what this is playing back to still sound as close to the original as possible, but at the same time discarding all the extra information. Is the high-pitched stuff important? Is the low-pitched stuff important? Variable bitrate MP3 will actually add more information in the sections that are more complex, where there's more frequencies, where there's more rhythm, where there's more motion, and it'll actually slow down the amount of information that it's grabbing in the sections that are either repetitive or monotonous or within the same area of the frequency spectrum. Well, video compression does the same thing. If you were to shoot a talking head giving them nightly news, the compressor is going to look at that in advance, and then it's going to say, if you do a two-pass compression, it'll look at it one time and it'll say, okay, nothing's moving here. Pretty much that black hair stays in the same place for the entire video. Those eyeballs stay in the same place for the entire video. So I don't have to do a lot of work here, and I can discard all this extra color information and gamma information and all this other stuff and spit out a very low-sized file, and it'll still look pretty much exactly like what started. But if you have an action sequence of somebody running through a dark forest and then suddenly out into a desert and there's sunlight and there's all this contrast and motion and movement, that compressor needs to figure out, how do I avoid making the diagonal lines on the railway of the staircase look jagged and instead make them look smooth and crisp like they should when they were originally shot? So a better compressor will deal with that in a proper way, and a poor compressor will make things just look grainier, blobbier, duller, and all of that.
Less pleasing to watch.
Less pleasing to watch overall. And even though right now we're in this kind of gold rush of, hey, I can throw up my video wherever I want and blah, 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 remember that over time you will have this legacy of material, and you may not have stored all of the source material that you originally created it from. So you'll never really be able, unless you're somehow, you have terabytes of hard drive space free to store the full resolution versions and all of the unedited material forever, a lot of the stuff that you're putting up, you may never have access to again. And the resolution that you put it up at now is going to be pretty much what the rest of the world has for as long as, you know, your name is around. I recommend putting up stuff that looks as great as possible now, even if nobody's watching it, because someday you may be the most famous person on Earth. You may be here to save the galaxy, and we're going to want to go back and see your great works of art. So look into the different kinds of compression. I found that using Windows Media Video 9 is actually one of the best looking ones on YouTube. I find QuickTime doesn't look so good on YouTube. Flash Video is always looking better, and when that's an option, I recommend using it. But again, make sure you understand the settings. Variable bitrate means that, like I said, it will prioritize sections that have a lot of dynamic range more and the areas that have less going on so that you optimize your file size. Two-pass variable bitrate means that it'll take a scan over it once, decide how to do this, and then on the second pass, implement the compression. So that's really important. If you wanted to make a great video and you recognize that music contributes to the success of a video, remember too that if someday your stuff becomes famous and wants to be broadcast and you can't go back to the source material and you're using somebody's music that you haven't paid for or don't have a license for, you're going to either have to A, pay for it at that time, which could become very expensive, or you're going to have to replace it and the dialogue and everything else. However, there is a solution for you. There's a thing called the Creative Commons license, which is where thousands and thousands of tracks have become available by artists for free, and the exchange is that you generally just have to credit them. So instead of using that old bad habit of yours of just grabbing whatever the hell you like and putting it up there without credit, the difference is, A, check to see if there's a Creative Commons license and give that artist a credit and a link back. Or if you're using some enormously famous Britney Spears track, at least give credit for the track, and then later on you can deal with the licensing fees when this thing is going to be broadcast in the Super Bowl. But go look for that. You can look for PodSafe Music, look at Creative Commons. If you use Flickr.com, you're already familiar with Creative Commons, where you have the option to make your photographs available under the Creative Commons license or not. And these songs are not ones you'll ever have to pay for. They're just artists who want to get spread, you know, out there. They want people to hear their music. They want people to hear the name. And it's good business for them. I've learned, having been in the music industry for 20-something years and run a record label and so on, that it's finally showing what the right solution was to the whole internet major labels collision. Give the stuff away for free. You'd be lucky if people want it. It's actually almost more difficult to get pirated than not.
Yeah.
It's not because you should pirate music, but because if your stuff is out there, then people can listen to it. And there will be a way later down the line where you can monetize that. It'll be through touring, it'll be through merchandise, and so on. It's the same idea with videos. If you create a legacy and a brand, that's an important thing. You need to think about your brand and how you're going to link all of the videos that you put up there. It doesn't have to be your name. It doesn't have to be some big corporate logo. You don't need a trademark. But just think about what you're putting out there. Using an alias or a pseudonym or a fake company name is perfectly fine if it makes you feel more comfortable with what you're putting out there. Another little secret tip I just wanted to give you guys is the way that videos can be distributed is forever expanding and being creatively adjusted. Just a cool little hack you can try out. I posted one of my far too many blogs that I have. It's blogging-fool.com. And on Blogging Fool, I put up a post about how you can actually turn a YouTube subscription into a podcast in iTunes. So that, for example, if you subscribed to my video channel, every time I posted a new video, that would show up immediately as a video in your iTunes and could be uploaded right to your iPod every time you plug it in.
Wow.
So that's a little piece of code that you can just add in. If you read the article, you'll see exactly how to do it. There's a video explaining it. And you got to realize that there are that many ways for people to be watching your video. The question is, do you know who they are? Do you know how many of them there are? If you were able to know who they are and their names and their home addresses, then you'd be violating all sorts of privacy. But
at least knowing the demographic and...
Yeah, the more you can know about how many people, at least on a given day, how many unique IP addresses is more important. That's stuff you can actually take to the bank. Mm-hmm. If you can show, not that you had 500,000 views by the same two people clicking like crazy monkeys at a keyboard, but if you had 500,000 unique computers watch that video, you're in the money. But you need to have a way to track it. This is one of the reasons why YouTube has become so successful is because advertisers really take those numbers actually seriously. They are able to say, wow, this is the unique number of views that this video's had. This is better than the Nielsen ratings. We now know exactly how many people, their IPs are located in this country, in this country, in this country. They watched it at this time, and this time, and this time. This is a dream come true. So wherever you're able to track as much information as you can, you're going to not only have that information as a resource for yourself, looking for advertisers and other opportunities, but also you're going to have a way to assess how successful the stuff you're putting up is coming across. You'll be able to gauge some minor adjustment I made in that show made it tank or it made it explode. And as you go through it and you put up more and more material, you'll start to understand the patterns. These are not always easy things. Even Procter & Gamble can put up an ad that goes completely crazy and not be able to figure out exactly what it was. But they're pretty damn good at it at this point because they understand how those tools work. Anyways, we should close, but I did want to talk about a final way that we're finally seeing how videos will not only be monetized, but will be successful and in some ways start to replace conventional television as we know it. There's a new show available exclusively pretty much on Xbox, Zune.
And Sprint phones.
Sprint phones and obviously YouTube and its own website called The Guild.
Love it.
The Guild is a webisodic, 8-minute episodes that was created by Felicia Day, who made some guest appearances, was a sort of recurring on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but also was an avid World of Warcraft player, and decided to talk about, or to base a show around the people that are in a guild and how they react and respond to each other and what their relationship means online versus offline.
I think it's hilarious.
This show has appeal for people who aren't even massively multiplayer online role players. This is
right.
You don't have to have played World of Warcraft or EverQuest to get the appeal of this because it's about people and their relationships and their quirks and their foibles and their love interests. And she manages to do this in 8-minute episodes that leave you gasping for breath, waiting for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
They've only done 2 seasons. The first season was 10 episodes. The second was 12 episodes.
And there was even stunts in the second season.
Yeah. I mean, they're low, low budget, but they're shot in 24p. They look gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
You can download them for free. This is the most important thing to point out.
Yes.
There are dozens of independent shows available on the Xbox Live Marketplace. They're available for 160 Microsoft points, which is $1.60. I could care less. There's ones that are available for 40 cents. I don't want them because I don't know what they are. The Guild was free.
From day one.
Sprint footed the bill for this. This is a genius, genius marketing strategy on the part of the creators of the show, on the part of Sprint, on the part of Xbox.
Well, it got it out there and then the buzz starts rolling and then people get obsessed and who knows, we'll be watching it on...
Well, we'll be watching it exactly where we're watching it. That's the point.
It
doesn't
actually
have to migrate to television anymore to be successful. When you have an installed user base the size of Xbox, of YouTube, and so on, going crazy about something, you can be seeing 20, 30 million views.
Yep.
It doesn't matter anymore. That you can get more views via YouTube than Lost could in its peak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how it works. And that's because you can watch it anywhere. You can watch it on your phone. You can watch it on your Zune. You can watch it on your laptop at the coffee shop. You don't have to be in front of a television anymore.
You can watch it at work.
So The Guild is, to me, and I wrote a blog about this at theculturepin.com. I think it's like the Mary Tyler Moore for the next generation. It's basically about a woman who's living on her own, and she can do it on her own, and she can do it her way. But it works. The 8-minute segments, the commercial-free segments, work perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best integration of all of the things that the big IT people said needed to happen up until this point. I have not seen a better webisodic pull off the balance between marketing, between how to deal with the lack of advertising space, how to deal with the short attention span, how to shoot on a low budget, still build a subscriber base, build a rabid fan base. Felicia Day, who I follow on Twitter, has been writing about one signing after another. She's been at conference after conference signing autographs for people for up to 5 hours straight.
No, she's part creator.
She's producer and creator and lead actress.
You got to get her on the show.
Yeah, we're working on getting an interview with Felicia because she is exactly what I'm talking about.
That would
be
a
perfect model.
Yeah, mine to pick.
Exactly. I'd love to hear just how she got Sprint on board, because that, I'm sure, was the clincher. I'm pretty sure the story has to do with start on YouTube, watch it go viral, make a bid,
mm-hmm.
and Sprint sees the light. They see that the subject matter is like, she's not only tapping into the Xbox Live audience, she's not only tapping into the 8-minute webisodic thing, because 8 minutes is long for YouTube. she's tapping into the World of Warcraft market.
Which is huge.
When you put all those things together, we're talking about an installed 40 million person or more user base that is starving for material targeted at them.
Yeah.
Nobody is making stuff for these people. And the old guys that think that they're going to make something cool for those role-playing computer nerds totally don't get it.
Yeah.
They're like the guys that would make, you know, a surfing movie about web surfing. Like when Rocky and Bullwinkle, the movie, tried to be cool about him web surfing. And there's like Rocky like riding around on a surfboard through the internet. This is like speaking at eye level. It totally gets it. It's going to go massive.
It's hilarious.
It's going to be a historic footnote that says that was the turning point. Watch this. This is the, you know, they're going to teach it in virtual schools. I'm just saying. Give it away, give it away, give it away now.
All great advice and tips. My mind is a reeling right now.
Well, obviously we could go on into much greater depth in all of these things, but I would be happy to receive any questions from you guys. You can write to me at info@karamcast.com, K-E-R-A-M-C-A-S-T. I will try to include some of the links to the articles I talked about on the website. And also, we have a little link up for Skype on the site, which we use to do all of our interviews. Check that ad out on the site and click through. See if you're interested in becoming a part of the Skype Out program, which lets you basically call anywhere in the world for just pennies, literally. You can take inbound calls. You can even get your own phone number. It's something like $30 a year, and you can have your own Skype phone number that people can call like a regular phone.
That's great.
It's awesome. And if you buy like one of the Skype mobile handsets for like $120, you can say bye to your cell phone carrier and all of that. You just have Skype it wherever you go. You're literally paying like nothing. It's almost free. So anyways, that's one of my affiliates. It's the only affiliate I really decided to feature on the site because we use it and we think it's awesome. If you do click through from our site, we get a little piece and supports the show, but whatever. It's not an ad. It's not an infomercial. I just wanted to point that out as an example of how to do it yourself. And feel free to call the phone number that's listed at karamcast.com, and you can actually leave your questions that way. And if we like your voicemail message or we find a place for it, we'll just feature your voice on the next podcast.
Then you'll hear your sexy self over the airwaves.
Yeah, and everywhere where we broadcast.
Live.
Thanks for listening to the Karamcast. Amy, always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks.
Even if you're just sitting there listening.
I was listening in awe tonight. I just, a lot of information.
Well, listening is a fine art, and I appreciate it. And thanks for always coming out to help me through this.
Thank you.
See you guys next time.